I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture, with me, Neil Denny.
This week, I'm talking to North Carolina-based writer Philip Lewis about his debut novel, The Barrowfields.
Philip Lewis is a writer living in Charlotte, North Carolina. He worked in a courtroom as a lawyer for around 9 years and wrote The Barrowfields, his debut novel, across 5 years while continuing to work as a lawyer. And it's The Barrowfields that we're going to be talking about today. Philip, welcome to Little Atoms.
Thanks very much for having me.
So describe to me The Barrowfields.
The book it's a deeply American saga. It's set primarily in the high mountains of North Carolina, in a small town that I have created called Old Buckram. And it's also set in the Piedmont of North Carolina and in the low country of South Carolina. And in this small insular town in the mountains of North Carolina, there's a young boy named Henry who grows up in a house where there are no books. And he quickly comes to find out, though, that he, despite this circumstance, that he loves books and he loves to read. And he loves the written word, and he finds himself going to the library all the time. And in fact, at one point, he stays in there so long as to get locked in the library overnight. And his mother just doesn't understand what to do with his exceptional literacy. But at some point, he does escape the gravity of Old Buckram, and he goes away, and he goes off to college, and he begins a career writing. And he believes, like so many writers do, I think, that there's something special in him. There's a way that he views the world which is special, and it's unique, and he has this voice that he wants to find, and he begins searching for this voice, and he writes some short stories and to some acclaim. But it's then that his mother becomes sick, and he has to return to Old Buckram, to this small town. And he goes back there, and he's viewed as an outsider. And he's sort of out of place and out of time there, and I think some of that is self-imposed. But here he installs his young family. He has a wife at this point and a young son, also named Henry, and he installs them in this decaying Gothic mansion on the side of a mountain, inside of which there's a library of 10,000 books. And when he first finds this house, he walks in and he says, you know, oh, here I can write. And so his son, Henry, is there, and then they have another daughter named Trinity. And all this story is told by Henry's son, who grows up in the shadow of his father's writing desk. And his entire life is informed by literature. I mean, you can imagine this young man growing up in this dark, this bleak mansion, where every word comes out of his that comes out of his father's mouth has something to do with literature, and it's a reference to T.S. Eliot or Keats or Wordsworth or you name it, and that his entire worldview is described in terms of this sort of literary heritage. Well, tragedy strikes the family as it does in these sorts of stories, and the father abandons the family and leaves them in this mansion. So the story, the son, our faithful narrator, he is going to, years later, tell you what happened. He's going to unspool this narrative. It's shrouded in mystery.
So tell me about Old Buckram. So as you mentioned, it's a fictional creation, but you did grow up yourself in a North Carolina mountains in, I guess, a similar town. And we'll talk about your own growing up a little bit more detail a bit later. But tell us about what Old Buckram is like, the fictional version.
So, well, let me just start by saying that the town that I grew up in, which was called West Jefferson, is, I think, objectively a beautiful town in the mountains of North Carolina. And it was the kind of place that I think if I were to describe it to you, you would say it's the kind of place where you'd like to visit. You know, the weather is not ideal, but it's wonderful in the summers. And they do get a bit of snow and that sort of thing. But the people are kind and they're generous and everybody knows everybody else. And it's just generally a sort of a lovely place to be.
I've been to Asheville, which is a wonderful place to visit.
Oh, Asheville is absolutely incredible. And it's not that dissimilar from Asheville, except it's just much smaller. It's probably 2 hours to the northeast of Asheville. But with Old Buckram, what I wanted to do was I wanted to sort of capture more of the darkness that you sometimes find in small mountain towns. And the idea was, for me, you know, growing up there, I think it's a great place probably to raise children. But it may not be a great place to grow up as a child, because at least in the years when I was there, there wasn't much culture. There weren't many activities. You know, like here I live in Charlotte now, and I can, you know, you can go see a play anytime you want. You can go to, you know, the theater, the orchestra, whatever the case may be. But it really wasn't like that when I grew up. And I think that I felt, maybe more than some other people, the sort of the insular or the enclosed nature of it. And so I wanted to create a town that when described, the reader would be able to feel those aspects of the closeness and sort of the bleak aspect and the darkness of it, but also sort of the wit and the humor, too, that goes with folks that live in the mountains. And I don't know, you may have picked up on some of this while you were out there, but the folks that live in the mountains are incredible storytellers, and almost everyone is. And you can meet someone on the street, and before they say anything else to you, they'll set in on some kind of story or an anecdote. And all of it's extraordinarily clever. And there's a tremendous amount of nuance and complexity to the people who live there. And one thing I found is that so many stories that people write about the North Carolina mountains, they make the people who live there caricatures. And they sort of describe us all as folks with maybe a lower intellect, and they ascribe to us an accent or a dialect that sort of suggests limited education and that sort of thing. And really nothing could be further from the truth. And if you actually go and you sit down and talk to people who live in this area, you'll find how incredibly vibrant and intelligent that they are, and how they do tell you these stories that are so fascinating and so interesting. And so in order to really adequately portray an authentic picture of what life is like there, you know, you really have to round it out and include all these details. And that's what I've tried to do with my Old Buckram.
And that's obviously an oral storytelling technique. But of course, you've also mentioned the fact that, you know, Henry's mother in the novel is suspicious of books. Where does that come from?
Well, you know, that's a good question. I mean, I think that might play a little bit into the stereotype that I just mentioned. You know, which is that the folks in that area are suspicious of learning. And I think, I mean, there is some of that. There's no question about it. If you get, you know, far enough up into the mountains, you will find folks who place a lower value on literacy than perhaps other people might. So it definitely does exist, and it is a phenomenon. But it really, you know, the idea was to, you know, to place this young man in a situation where his love affair with literature would be brought out in the clearest way possible.
I wanted to talk about the house, as described as the Vulture House in the book. And again, as you've described, it's like a classic Gothic house from fiction. The house itself has a tragic past. And you describe everything in this book is described so vividly and so completely. But tell us something about this amazing house.
The house is, as I say, it's a decaying mansion. It's set up on the top of a hill, there in the mountains, and it sort of sits in a place where, due to the way that the ridges of the mountain it's sort of perpetually in shadow, and it has an eerie past. There's some things that I describe in the book. Something awful happened in this house. No one knows exactly what, and it's the subject of much discussion in the town, and everybody has a different idea about what they think happened there, and that's one of the reasons why it's sitting there vacant, and it's something that Henry the father, when he returns to Old Buckram, that he can come along and move his family in. And it looks like a kind of house that would be maybe designed floor to ceiling by Edgar Allan Poe, and I think someone has suggested that before. And I read a lot of Poe, and I like his imagery. And, you know, when I first started writing the book, I hadn't described the house in that way. It took several iterations, but in order to make it to give it the dark quality that I wanted, it eventually became this mansion of iron and glass with all irregular angles and that sort of thing. And it was so much fun to write about it. All the rooms have so much character, and as I mentioned before, in the middle of the house, sort of in the heart of the dwelling, there's this extraordinary library. In the middle of the library is an enormous aperture through which you can see down into the floor below, and another one in the ceiling where you can see all the way up to the roof. And it's in the corner of this library where Henry the father has his writing desk, and that's where he sits day in and day out and attempts to pen his magnum opus, while his son sits there on the floor with him, literally in the shadow of his father's writing desk, and absorbs this literary character that's going to define him.
And the title of the book, The Barrow Fields, refers to the surroundings of this house, which are these sort of rocky fields where nothing will grow. Tell us about that. Is that a real thing?
No, that's not a real thing. There is a place out in the western part of the state, western part of North Carolina, southwest of Asheville, and it's on the Blue Ridge Parkway. And that's sort of where the inspiration came from. It's sort of a field, and it's an overlook on the Blue Ridge Parkway. And you drive up there, and there's a sign, and it says something like, "For some reason, nothing will grow on this land." And it looks drab and drear, and a little bit depressing. And it's not honestly much to behold. But I was driving out there one day, and I read the sign, and it occurred to me that would make such an extraordinary setting in a book. And the way I describe it in the book is this place that's sort of between the Vulture House and this small town, which is down in the valley. And it is a place where nothing will grow, and there are stumps that the locals think maybe they're all covered with this creeping gray moss, some of the locals think that they're grave markers. They're sort of headstones that have been there for thousands of years. And other folks think that there was something called a wind blow, which is apparently a thing that you sometimes see in mountain lore. A wind blow came up over the hills and blew away all the nutrients in the soil, and basically just rendered the land sterile so that nothing but this creeping gray moss would ever grow there.
And I just wanted to say something about some of the names in the novel. You mentioned Threlody, the daughter, and that's a ballad, a sort of keening lament. And Henry Jr.'s love interest in the book is called Story. And you've mentioned this idea of the sort of, the oral storytelling techniques. So tell me about some of these names.
Well, so everything in the book, I think, is done sort of that way. Almost everything. Almost all the names and the place names, they have some extrinsic significance that, you don't have to know these things in order for the story to have meaning. But if you do, it will add some meaning. And some of them are serious, and some of them are jokes, which, I enjoy very much finding things like that. And little Easter eggs, literary Easter eggs is what I call them, in books that other people have written. And so it goes from this. You start with the title, or not the title, but the primary setting for the book, Old Buckram. And of course, buckram is a type of it's like a linen or a cotton that you stiffen with glue, and you make book covers out of it. And so my idea was to have this story take place within Old Buckram, which is to say, within the covers of an old book. And it kind of goes from there. Story, of course, is that's a rather obvious one. But then you have characters like there's an old mountain preacher named Harold Specs, who is he's this fellow who just condemns everyone to hell with all this hellfire and brimstone, and he has a rather unacademic conception of the Holy Scripture, you could say. And his name comes from Heruspex, of course, which is, you know, was a species of priest that used to tell futures and that sort of thing by looking at the entrails of animals, you know, and essentially, and it became, I think Mencken expanded the term to something more broad, you know, sort of any charlatan of that sort of thing. And so there's another character named Stu Brett who gets one sentence in the book. Just sort of a comedic a reference, and of course, you know, that goes with the term soubrette. And so there's layer upon layer of these things. Some of them are more serious than others, like Trinity, of course. I think the sort of the hidden heart of the book is Trinity and her relationship with her brother and how they come to terms with the departure of her father. And her name, I think, is apt in this particular story.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
You're listening to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny. Today I'm talking to Philip Lewis, and we're talking about his debut novel, The Barrow Fields. And Philip, I read a article that was published in Granta that you wrote, where you described the process of writing this book and described the book as an emotional autobiography. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think that for me, I wasn't interested in telling any aspect of the true facts of my own life or the real experiences that I've had. And part of that was because, and I think that's a very difficult thing for a writer to do. It causes you to be honest with yourself in a way that's difficult. And I think also, I'm not sure that it would have been particularly interesting. At least it would not have been interesting to me in order, you know, to do something like that. And what I really wanted to do with this book was to take out and examine certain emotional experiences that I'd had and deal with them somehow through the written word. And I think I figured this out as the process went along. But, You know, I had certain experiences whenever I was in high school, whenever I was a young man, experiences with my father that I came away from with sort of this weight of emotion that I wanted to find some way to articulate. And in order to do that, I created this town, this old Buckram town, and these characters and this completely different landscape. And using these pieces, using these characters and this new place, I tried to paint on this canvas the emotions that I had experienced in other places and in other times. And in doing so, I was able to hold these things up to the light, as it were, and come to better understand them. I mean, if I'm trying to write a scene where I'm capturing maybe a feeling of loss that I might have felt, or a feeling of exuberance, or love or hope or whatever the case may be, I mean, it really takes some real introspection and some real craft, I think, to satisfy yourself that you've accurately portrayed the things that you're trying to portray. And so instead of saying, well, this had autobiographical elements, it really doesn't. If you look at the actual facts and things, the actual story that's told, none of these things happened to me in my life necessarily. But I think that the emotions that are depicted in the pages of this book, those things are all very real to me on a very fundamental level.
But you talk about, in that same article, about how your father's reluctance at you writing a book was sort of echoed in Henry and his mother's relationship. And then you go on to talk about how you had some regrets about your own relationship with your daughter when she was growing up, and how that has sort of filtered down into the relationship between the younger Henry and his sister Threnody. And I guess one of the themes of this book is how these patterns are repeated through the generations, isn't it?
Yes, that's right. And that is something that's a phenomenon that I've observed within my own family. And it is interesting to see history repeat itself in that way. And I don't think we like to think that we're susceptible to those sorts of things. For example, my father is an alcoholic, and who suffered from depression for years and years and years and years. And it's something that we deal with just about every day. And in fact, he was just in the hospital. He just got out of the hospital a couple of days ago. And he had to go back in for treatment for the alcoholism. And as soon as he was home again, he began drinking again. And 5 minutes before this phone call with you, I had heard that he has perhaps disappeared. No one knows where he's gone. And so, but it's this sort of a legacy that he has. And as a man and his son, I tell myself that I'm surely not going to have issues with depression or alcoholism. I mean, you know how that is. And of course, I have a daughter who, you know, you and I have talked about, who's now 28 years old. And what's alarming is when you start to see certain historical repetitions in yourself, but what's even more alarming is when you begin to see them with a child. And I think that's a very powerful notion. So that it was very deliberate on my part to try to fill in some of those lines between these characters here in this book.
Just one more thing from me then. I just wanted to talk about some other writers that have influenced you. As I said, this book is so beautifully written, it does not read at all like a debut novel. You mentioned Poe. Who else has been an influence on this book?
I tell you, I think just about everything I read influences me in one way or another. I read all the time. I love language, and so it's just about anything I read, I feel like I take away just a little bit of some aspect of it. I love probably Thomas Wolfe more than any other writer, although, you know, he certainly had his own troubles with, you know, trying to be concise. He wrote an incredible book called The Autobiography, or this is not a book that he wrote, but it's a book that contains two of his essays called The Autobiography of an American Novelist. And these are speeches that he gave. One was in 1935, I think. One was in 1937, where he talked about the writing process and how he just wrote and wrote and wrote millions of words and had a tremendous difficulty, you know, actually just sort of starting a story and having some normal plot development and concluding it. But nevertheless, the authenticity and the sincerity with which he wrote have always been inspirational to me. But I love Faulkner and Tolkien and William Styron and David Mitchell. I think I've read every word that you can find on David Mitchell, Fitzgerald, Camus, Carl Sagan, Stephen Jay Gould, Evelyn Waugh, Mencken, H.L. Mencken, of course, Tennessee Williams. But it just sort of, you know, it depends on the day. And but I find meaning in so many books that you could just about, I mean, I've got a little library in my house, and you could pull a book off the shelf, and I would say, oh, yes, that one. Let me tell you what I loved about that. And when you do that, when you sit down to write, it's hard not to take just a little piece of each one of those things with you.
To finish it off then, could I get you to read a little piece of the Barrowfields for us?
Oh, absolutely. All right, so where I'm going to read from is, this is a point at which Henry is 8 years old, and he has been caught stealing books from the library. A year later, his library privileges were permanently revoked when it was discovered that he had, over the course of several months, removed more than 100 books from the school library's repository of reading material. The heist was revealed when Maddie went in one day to change his sheets and nearly fractured her left foot on the spine of Brideshead Revisited. She threw back the bedclothes at once and discovered his literary plunder. The books were stacked in neat alphabetical rows under the bed he shared with his brother, who had said nothing of the enterprise. And he had done all this without raising a modicum of suspicion from anyone, including the waspish librarian, Mrs. Tichborne, who preferred that no one check out books in the first place. An interrogation followed in the school's tiny detention room, where a large wooden paddle, marked with holes, hung ominously on the wall. "What were you going to do with all those books?" asked Bent Smith, the school principal, who had threatened to expel the chronically bibliophilic boy. Mr. Smith was tall and thin like a young birch tree, but he had an awful curvature to his spine that made him half as tall as he might have been otherwise. As a boy, he'd been scalded with boiling water from a kettle that held the family's clothes he'd been assigned to wash. A wooden leg of the pot rotted and gave out, so he was spotted like a cow, and part of his face was sallow, and one half of his mouth was turned down, giving him a look of permanent and aggravated dyspepsia. Mr. Smith was conducting the examination. Mrs. Tichborne, who, by all reports, was blind as a cavefish from staring so many years at Melville Dewey's damnable taxonomic invention, stood anxiously at Mr. Smith's shoulder. She had a long history of discouraging students from reading, particularly with respect to books of more prurient interest, like fiction, and had it been up to her, she would have summoned the State Bureau of Investigation and asked them to issue warrants. Unable to control herself any longer, she demanded to know what he was going to do with her books under his bed, and the very question implied an indecency about the whole affair. "I plan to read them," said my father, who'd been positioned in a fraying, cane-backed chair in the middle of the room with his inquisitors circling like a couple of buzzards. "In fact, I've already read most of them." He began to explicate a detailed and heretofore unformulated hypothesis about the human mind's psychological readiness to read a given book at a given moment, and how important, nay, critical, it was to have the book one wanted to read at the absolute ready when the inspiration struck. The gist was that when you decide you want to read something, you want it handy so you can dive right in. His argument was not persuasive. "He was just going to read 'em," Helton came to his son's defense, and just in time. "It's not like he was going to sell 'em. Not exactly a market up here for books, you'll admit. You can't punish the boy for wanting to read." "Yes, that's true," said Mr. Smith. "But he could have read them just the same by checking them out one at a time."
I've been talking to Philip Lewis. We've been talking about The Barrowfields, which is out now in the UK from Scepter Books. Philip, thank you so much for sharing it with us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by Neil Denny and was broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM.
You can find the Little Atoms podcast on iTunes and you can follow the show on Twitter at Little Atoms.
If you'd like to donate a little money to support the show, you can do so at littleatoms.com. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Before Shopify, were you wondering, where are my sales at? Now you're selling with Shopify, the global commerce platform supercharging your selling. You have no problem selling online, in person, on social media, and beyond. Gary, easy on the cha-ching.
Oh, sorry, but my Shopify sales are through the roof.
Start selling with Shopify today and discover how millions of businesses around the world use Shopify to ignite their selling. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/listen. Shopify.com/listen.